At a constitutional law conference. I've got slides today because I did recall from this venue that it has this enormous screen. The first slide is just to illustrate that I've drawn the short straw today. That's just the length of the nine, was it nine? Well, I only found seven. George Williams found nine constitutional cases last year. You can see Dixon's the shortest. It's 38 paragraphs long, about 4,000 words, about the length of an undergraduate law school paper. Now, it might seem like I'm lucky to have a short judgment to talk about, especially in the limited time, but like an undergraduate law school paper, quick to read, easy to grade, but if you have to give feedback, you find you have to do a lot more work than you suspect the student did in the original paper. So to take that weight, I've actually written a lengthy paper. It's about three times the length of Dixon. It certainly doesn't go into the judgment in great depth, but that's really going to cover most of what I have to say. What I'll give you now are just the highlights. All right, and so I've also drawn the short straw in this. This is a unanimous judgment. It has no interesting dissents, so I can't just say Titani is wrong, read Hayden. I have to do some more work myself. And it's also on the least sexy provision in the Constitution, Section 109. But before you all start heading for the door, the facts at least are fun, and I will endeavour to argue that the case actually has some quite significant potential consequences. All right, so on to the facts, and I'm going to go through the facts. Boy, well, I had some pretty pictures. I'm going through the facts in part just to tell you what this thing called concurrent criminal offences is, the system of concurrent criminal offences. You might not remember that from your criminal law classes, and that's because the system of concurrent criminal offences, overlapping criminal offences, is one of those things you don't even notice exists until you lose it and realise what a handy thing it was. All right, so to illustrate that, the centre of the case, and that picture made it online, is 7.87 million Marlboro cigarettes, and they were imported by a group called Feel Good Australia Proprietary Limited, a somewhat incongruous name, and I looked on their website to list who I think they are, and they are a cosmetics group. Anyway, the name's doubly incongruous, or at least was on the 20th of January 2004, because the cigarettes had all been seized by customs and were sitting in a cage in Port Melbourne and were due to be forfeited unless Feel Good managed to fight its case. In fact, they were forfeited to the Commonwealth on 2 weeks later in early February of that year, but by then legal ownership of the cigarettes was a bit of a moot point. So the cage was, of course, controlled by customs, but they actually leased the space from a group called Dominion Group. So that's the three pictures you can't see on the screen are the logos of those groups. At the bottom of the screen, you can see Victoria's provision on what it means for property to belong to another. And this isn't a property law question, it's a criminal law question. And criminal law doesn't care about the niceties of property law. Property belongs to another if it's controlled by another, possessed by another, or that person owns it in any way. And the whole purpose of this provision is just to leave out property which is owned by no one or property which happens to be owned by the person who stole it. That's all it does. You don't have to think about which of the three people was the owner, or at least you didn't have to. All right, so you know something's going to happen, like all good criminal law stories. And in this one, what happened before the 20th of January 2004, a week earlier, Dominion Group, the warehouse company, received a call from customs saying, look, we are going to pick up the cigarettes. We don't have room for them anymore. We're going to put them somewhere else or destroy them or something. And it was a bit complex because it's January. The guy who has the combination to the security card and the key to the padlock is away on holidays. So does Dominion mind typing in the combination and breaking the padlock at our expense? And then it was all arranged, and four men in three pickup trucks with obscured logos and covered-up license plates turned up at 5:30 in the morning to pick up the cigarettes, and all those measures were in place because thieves might be watching. And then the four men then stood and watched as Dominion Group loaded 30,000 cartons of Marlboros into the utes. The utes then drove away, and they said, we'll be back for the rest. And they didn't come back, and so 2 days later... Dominion rang up customs and said, well, when are you coming back for the rest of your cigarettes? And I wish I could have been there for that particular conversation. All right, so now the fun thing is, for a criminal lawyer, is just how many offences did these people manage to commit? And when you go through the Property Division of the Victorian Crimes Act, you come up with a lengthy list, just about everything short of armed robbery, and that's because they didn't need to do an armed robbery. All right, and here's the other point about concurrent criminal law. you don't have to work out a single offence to charge these people with. You can charge them with a lot. And in fact, the High Court said in 1998, if you need to, charge them with a lot. Cover as much behaviour as you can. We'll sort it all out when we get to sentencing if they get convicted of the lot. All right? So no need to worry, or at least you didn't have to worry. All right, but there's a further bit of overlap here. Because the cigarettes had been taken by customs, suddenly we're in the sphere of various bits of Section 51 of the Constitution and provisions enacted to enforce those sections. And so we have a huge list, not just in the Criminal Code, a very lengthy list I've given you there. Yeah, another weird picture there. I wonder what that was going to be. Anyway, and but also in the Customs Act, there's all these weird provisions I found in the Customs Act. I don't know if this is the end of it, but as you can see, a lot of provisions. The Commonwealth Crimes Act has a provision saying you can charge the lot and we'll work it out at the punishment phase. All right, so that's all easy, but then you get the question, well, but there's, do you charge the state ones, do you charge the Commonwealth ones, or do you charge both? And that's the issue that's raised in this case. All right, I'm not going to go. There is a history to this issue, but I won't be going into that history in great detail in this talk. It's covered in the paper. All right. Okay. Such a pity. All right. So I need to tell you a little more about how the case came to be before the High Court. Who's Dixon? Dixon was one of the people who the police eventually decided was involved in the plan to steal the cigarettes. There were a couple of other people who pled guilty, but Dixon and several others did not plead guilty, and the trials went about as well as the Dominion security went, in that just about everyone was acquitted in the first trial. There was just one charge left standing, which is a charge of conspiracy to steal against Dixon. They didn't know if he did the stealing, but he agreed to steal them. And in a later trial, a jury convicted him of that, and this was all done under state law. Because of the peculiarity of him being the last person left standing in a so-called conspiracy, this revisited an issue which had been previously thought to be settled, which is, can you be the only person found guilty of a conspiracy? The answer had been thought to be yes, but the High Court and the Victorian Court of Appeal wasn't remotely interested in the issue, but the High Court was interested, and in fact Justice Hayne encouraged Dixon to not just raise the evidence points he wanted to raise, but to attack the whole indictment, and he duly did that. All right, and then a funny thing happened. Dixon turned up to argue everything before the full High Court, and the first question from Chief Justice Fredge was, have you got our questions? And the questions weren't about conspiracy at all, but about Section 109. All right, so here you get this. Upon these grounds coming on for hearing, the appellant sought and obtained special leave to appeal on a ground based upon the operation of Section 109. And that's, as we say in criminal law, the truth, but not the whole truth. Not only was this issue raised by the High Court, but Dixon's response was, we're not interested. We thought about this issue before. We don't want to be tried with federal charges. We thought about it at trial. We don't see anything to this issue anyway. So can we get on with our appeal? Thanks, and I'd like bail for my client. And then he gets interrupted. You're not serving your client well, says the High Court. And in fact, I got sent emails of the transcript with members of the High Court bar, you know, laughing at poor old Tony Danos, Dixon's solicitor. He's a drink-driving solicitor, he says on his website, who seemed to think he was still in charge of his case. And after half an hour of banter about all the details, the High Court wanted to know exactly who had access to the cigarettes. The answer, of course, is anyone with a mobile phone. But eventually Danos asked to go outside for 15 minutes to have a bit of a think. And came back and said he would make the application, could he have a week to think up how to draft it? And he was worried about Section 78B. Justice Gummo declared, wrongly I think, that Section 78B wasn't a problem. And then he said, OK, I'll draft it after lunch, and the Chief Justice said, no, I'll draft it for you right now, and he did. Briefly paused to get Danos's assent, and as I point out in the paper, the grounds the Chief Justice drafted were wrong. They got the offence wrong, which turned out to be really important. They said that Dixon was convicted of theft. He was, in fact, convicted of conspiracy, and that's crucial to the case. I hope the Attorney Generals weren't misled by that in the Section 78B notices. All right. Now, I partly raise all that just to make the key point to you. This is a High Court-owned operation here. This is the High Court initiating an argument, and that perhaps sets it apart from some of the other cases the Court heard last year. The second point, which I'll only make briefly, is that I am somewhat critical of the procedures of the High Court in this area, and in the paper I do go at length about what I see as a number of inconsistencies and incongruities about the High Court's procedures. I think it's good to say that sort of thing sometime and not just grumble about it at the cafeteria or something, but to say it publicly. Leave that to the paper. All right, so on to the such crappy slides, onto the decision, which is what you're all interested in. And so there's meant to be a picture of Owen Dixon and Garfield Barwick, because in terms of the Section 109 jurisprudence, what the High Court did was do, let's go looking through the past cases and find a couple of quotes we like. And of course they chose Owen Dixon's quote about when a state law, if valid, would alter, impair or detract from the operation of the law, then to that extent it is invalid. They like that. But then they also quoted Garfield Barwick. And in Blackley, he talked about it's a direct being a direct collision if the state law imposes a greater obligation than the federal law. Now, I'm a big fan of Owen Dixon's quote, but I think there's limited use to Garfield Barwick's one. It might be useful in industrial arbitration cases, which is what Blackley was about. But in criminal law, all state laws impose a greater obligation. That's what criminal laws do. They impose obligations, and it's not clear to me where this test leads you. You would certainly have to, in order to apply it, think very hard about the operation of the two laws and whether they detract from each other. I'm not saying they can't detract from each other, but you need to do a detailed, a lot of practical thought about how the two laws interact. That didn't happen in this case. Instead, what the High Court did, and there's only 500 words of their 4,000-word judgment where they say anything much at all about the offences, the two offences in question. So the issue here is that there is a federal conspiracy to steal offence and there is a state conspiracy to steal offence, and they are different in some ways. The High Court listed four differences. Oh, I had some great pictures. that the federal offence, you can't charge someone with conspiring to commit an offence which is punishable by less than 12 months in prison. No federal conspiracies to jaywalk. You must prove that someone in the conspiracy did something. There's a withdrawal defence. And there is also a provision which picks up limitations to the offence, and they apply to the conspiracy as well. All right, this is where I'm desperate to spend more time, and I will hold off that and leave it to the paper. But the key to understanding Dixon is to understand just how trivial these four things are in the scheme of things. So one hint at understanding the trivia is the High Court doesn't talk about them. It just lists them. And then it has a paragraph where it said, well, we talked about conspiracy in a case a few months ago called LK. But they didn't talk about these four things in that case. They talked a little bit about one of them. And the case was actually all about how similar federal conspiracy was to state conspiracy. So in what they concluded, though, in Dixon, was that we decided that the federal provisions were a deliberate legislative choice. That's their words. And you know, they're not typos. The Parliament knew what they were doing when they passed it. That's true for the whole criminal code. But a choice to do what is the question left hanging. Second thing to tell you, and you'll have to take my word for this, unfortunately, but I do outline some of it in the paper. None of these four things, interesting as they sound, matter in the slightest in any real criminal trial. No one is ever charged with conspiracy to commit minor offences. There's always an overt act for complex reasons to do with why prosecutors like charging conspiracy. The withdrawal defence is a joke. It requires perfect timing, it is unpleasant, and is unreliable as a method of preventing conviction. And the defence provision is, you'd easily get there by regular statutory interpretation. The idea that the Commonwealth would charge someone with an offence, with conspiring to do an offence, knowing that person has a defence to the offence they conspired to do, is just nonsense. All right, to underline that, and I should point out, none of these have ever been the subject of a decision for good reason. To underline that, none of them applied to Kevin Dixon. None. All right. And finally, just, and this is a complex point to make, and it's that these are all very peculiar choices if you want to come up with a big gap between federal and state law. There are a number of reasons for that, but here's one of them. Remember, there are heaps of federal offences you could charge someone with. Conspiracy is just one of them, all right? And there are other offences which do the same thing as conspiracy but don't have any of these limits. The key example is the offence of general dishonesty, known as the conspiracy of one. If you engage in conduct, it can be an act or omission, with an intent to dishonestly get something from the Commonwealth. All right, no withdrawal defence, no overt act requirement, no requirement to prove someone's committed a crime at all, apart from intending to get something dishonestly from the Commonwealth. So to the extent that the state law detracts from the federal conspiracy defence, it doesn't detract from the rest of federal law, because the rest of federal law detracts from the federal conspiracy offence, right? What the Commonwealth gave in the general part of the criminal law, they took away in the specific part, the special part, and that's very common. All right, that's a race through the trivia. I need to cover one more point, though, and that is, they found another difference, a fifth difference between the two provisions, and that's Section 80 of the Constitution, right? Which you'll recall in Cheadle was held to require a unanimous verdict if the Commonwealth decides to have a trial by jury, a unanimous verdict in federal offences, not required in state ones. And the court, in a separate part of this judgment, said that's another reason to think that this is a bit suspicious, that we have two different conspiracy offences, one federal and state, different procedures. Now, the obvious point to make is, you know, Section 80 is not a law of the Commonwealth, it's an imperial law. A further point to make, which the High Court missed, is that it's Victorian law which specifically requires, whatever Section 80 might say, a unanimous verdict in federal cases. So the only federal law is the one which requires trials on indictment for federal conspiracy. And the state also requires trials on indictment for all conspiracy matters. So they're in furious agreement on this. This is an era which seems to be about picking up, I think, I've forgotten his name. Anyway, the judge who talked about state and federal cases, Justice Perrin, he pointed out that there's a way you can try and pick up constitutional provisions and wedge them into federal law and then use Section 109. The High Court engaged in that game. All right, why was the High Court doing this? Why were they so keen to find minor, trivial drafting differences as raising federal constitutional-level problems? They relied on Section 109's alternative rationale. It's not just about federalism, you'd all recall. Mess, Wally and Croom said it's also about citizens knowing their obligations. And it's important for everyone to know their concurrent obligations. As you all would know, Met Wally was about retrospective concurrent obligations. Croom was about prospective conflicting obligations. So they've extended that to prospective concurrent obligations. What can I say about this? But the idea that this is a burden on citizens, that they have two jurisdictions to deal with, is just bizarre. The nature of criminal law is you have to obey thousands of rules all at once. Who cares if there's 1,001 or 1,050? You know, I tried this out on my five-year-old. He came and asked me what I was writing my paper on, and I said, well, look, let me put it this way. If Julia, the boss of Australia, says you can't steal fruit apart from pears, and Ted, the boss of Victoria, says you can't steal fruit, can you steal a pear? And he said, no, because Ted says you can't. Right? That's what the High Court's concerned about, is people who don't get that. All right. Now, that just ends, believe it or not, the discussion of the judgment, because now I have to talk about its consequences. How am I doing for time in terms? Fine. Cool. All right. Discussion of consequences. And this is the bit where I have to do some writing for the High Court, because what the... what happened here? Did I go one too far? How do I get back? Well, who knows? Maybe that's what I had. All right. I thought I had up... All you learn from the High Court judgment of the consequences of this decision is Dixon was freed. That is, the High Court quashed the presentment and the conviction in his case. He can be recharged with a federal crime, though given he's spent so long in prison, perhaps he won't be. All right, but the big question in my mind is which bit of Victorian criminal law is invalid? And the High Court does not say. They do not declare which bit of Victorian criminal law is invalid. They just quashed the conviction, and that's a bit frustrating because... people want to know, I want to know at least, where the hole in Victorian criminal law is. Okay, you'll recall Section 109 ends, and is invalid to the extent of the inconsistency. They don't talk about that in the High Court. All right, so a couple of possibilities of what might be invalid. Firstly, I've given you the Dixon quote again. When a state law, if valid, would alter, impair or detract from the operation of the law of the Commonwealth Parliament, then to that extent it is invalid. Now, that would suggest that the five trivial differences that the High Court found between the two provisions, that's the area of invalidity of the Victorian law, just those minor differences. We know that's not the case, because if that was the case, then the High Court, by raising this issue... if that was the case, Dixon's conviction would have been upheld, because he is not in any of those areas of difference. His trial would have gone exactly the same, Commonwealth and state. He was convicted unanimously, amongst other things. And which means... if you went for that approach, the High Court just wasted a couple of months of everyone's time raising an issue which went nowhere for Dixon. So that wasn't the approach. The alternative extreme. Well, Dixon was convicted of the offence of conspiracy under Section 321 of the Victorian Crimes Act. Maybe that's invalid and has been since 2001. The picture I had there was of Carl Williams, who, if this was the case, would have been posthumously cleared of some of his most serious offences, but then so too would some of the people who conspired to kill him. A very even-handed approach, which is a good idea when you're dealing with a Melbourne gangland war. Okay, so it's not, I don't think, well, it's certainly not the first one, and I hope it's not the second. It's somewhere in the middle, okay? And so this bit of the paper, I had to pick apart the slim pickings in the judgment where they actually state the tests they're applying beyond just quoting Section 109 cases. And a number of the tests they state don't make any sense because they say they refer to the defendant doing conduct that would not be caught by the federal law, but Dixon's conduct was caught by the federal law. And so you have to pair them out, and you end up more or less with this sentence. The result in the present case is that in its concurrent field of operation in respect of conduct, the Victorian provision attaches criminal liability to conduct which falls outside the federal provision, and in that sense, directly collides. Okay, so the problem comes when you have conduct which is within the federal offence and not within the federal offence. That's tricky to parse. They're clearly talking about two different sorts of conduct. There's the conduct which is the concurrent field of operation, and then there's the conduct which is differently dealt with, and you have to distinguish those two. If there's conduct differently dealt with within the concurrent field of operation, then the statute is invalid in the whole field of concurrent operation. So in the there's the concurrent field of operation, or one of the concurrent fields of operation of these two provisions is people who make an agreement to steal federal property. They're concurrent, but there's an area of difference, overt acts and all of that, and so therefore the state law is invalid in its entire area of concurrent operation. Minor differences lead to major invalidity. All right, now I need to explain how annoying this is. If you're a Victorian prosecutor who wants to charge someone. So the pictures I actually had, one picture was of just a person leaping into a car to steal a laptop. So you're watching a couple of teenagers, they're about to leap into the car to steal the laptop, you arrest them, you want to charge them with conspiracy, but it all depends on who owns that laptop. Is it a federal public service laptop, or is it just a plain old laptop? What if the car drives away before you ever know? All right, you have to do a factual inquiry, even though it doesn't matter to state law, to work out the ownership of the federal of the property. Is there a federal hand in that property? All right, and ownership now becomes a really hard issue, which you have to think through very carefully. It's not enough just to understand, well, someone owns it. The federal government might have a slight hand in that property. What if instead of stealing a laptop, they stole a handbag and they contained an Australian passport? Australian passports, you'd all be aware, are owned and operated by the federal government. It says so in the Australian Passport Act. So you have to wonder, does that mean it belongs to the government in the criminal law sense? And every state prosecutor, state police officer is going to have to sort this out. It gets worse because it's not just theft you have to worry about. You have someone shoplifting in a shop and they steal their can of tomatoes. Well, they're stealing a can of tomatoes from Coles, but they're also depriving the Commonwealth of the GST. It's a defrauding the Commonwealth, general dishonesty, if there's two of them, conspiracy to defraud the Commonwealth of GST. All right? And state officers have to think about that as well. And this is just in the area of conspiracy to steal, but it gets worse. So the next bit of the story is this area of concurrent criminal law is big. It wasn't so big several decades ago. It is vast now. I got bored of cutting and pasting different act names. I looked for all the savings clauses. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of potential concurrency. Most of the criminal code and heaps of other acts are in an area of concurrency. One possibility, the Chemical Weapons Act. There's a case before the US Supreme Court being argued next week where the chemical weapons provisions of the federal US system were used to prosecute a domestic poisoning case. Now, that raises interesting issues in the US about the reach of federal power, but here it raises issues about the validity of state domestic poisoning prosecutions, even though no one would dream of using the Chemical Weapons Act, the federal one, to prosecute those cases. All right, but I've highlighted the big one, which is drugs. For those who aren't aware of the drug issue, you might remember 233B of the Customs Act from your criminal law days, but it's been abolished and there is now an entire part of the criminal code, and it gets rid of the distinction between imported and non-imported drugs. The Commonwealth has tried to criminalise all aspects of drug dealing in Australia, and they did that in 2005. Now, that didn't actually apparently change any practices of prosecution, the state laws were still used, but by being there now, they raise an issue about whether the state laws can be used in the future and indeed have been usable since 2005. That issue was in fact argued just last week in the High Court. There should be a picture here of Vera Momcilovic. You'd remember her, for those of you who follow human rights law, this is the star human rights case from Victoria, which was in the High Court to argue things about the Charter, but it's now turned in part into a Section 109 case. Just by the fluke that Vera Momcilovic's drugs were found in her fridge just 6 weeks after the new Commonwealth regime kicked in. So the argument is whether, because the state laws are so much less protective of defendants than the Commonwealth, we have a Section 109 inconsistency, not just in the area of less protection, but in the entire field of concurrency. Now, just to underline just how dangerous that is, perhaps, and I go through this in the paper, the Commonwealth and the states together or separately can solve this problem in the future and get rid of the Dixon problem in some way with some painful changes to either of their criminal law. But there's nothing you can do about convictions that have happened to date or are in fact continuing to happen while the states and Commonwealth do nothing. Met Wally stops you from saving those convictions. They're all gone if this argument rides. All right, final bit of the talk. Do we have time? Or yes? All right, final bit of the talk. Is there a way out of this? All right, and believe me, I'm sure you're all thinking it. Every time I've mentioned this issue to everyone and I talk to everyone I can about it, they all say, oh, the High Court won't let this happen. Right? And I think, well, thank God for the High Court. The argument is, of course, that they will do a kind of backflip and not follow through on the full force of their reasoning, and that would be great. I go through at length in the paper just how much they've boxed themselves in with their reasoning. Remember, they raised this issue, but they also specifically chose to deal with it as direct rather than indirect inconsistency. There are two hooks in the judgment which are left as a potential distinguishing. One is the High Court talks about the previous unanimous decision on Section 109 and concurrent criminal offences, McWaters and Day. That's where Sergeant Day crashed his car while drunk in the Enoggera Barracks. He was charged under Queensland drunk driving law. He wanted to be charged under military discipline drunk driving law because he was in a barracks. And the High Court said, no, they clearly intended to operate concurrently. All right. Now, the High Court looked back on that case in Dixon and said, well, we don't know about that bit. They didn't talk about that bit, but they said, you know what was different? The differences between the Commonwealth and state offence weren't to protect liberty. There was a difference. The Queensland offence says if you're drunk and you drive, you're convicted. The federal law said if you're drunk and you drive badly, then you're convicted. The High Court said, well, that's not protecting anyone's liberty. Right? And I don't know. I think there's a bunch of people in the drink driving bar who think that's a crucial issue. I drive if I'm drunk when I'm sober, right? But there are people who are drunk who drive nicely. And they feel that they're being maligned by Queensland law. Anyway, what's important is the High Court says that's not an area of liberty. So we know that not all differences are areas of liberty. All right, but there are plenty of definite areas of liberty in areas like drugs. The second hook is savings clauses. Right, there is a saving clause in the criminal code about theft law, federal theft law. There's savings clauses just about everywhere in the criminal code. But the High Court said not in Chapter 2, which defines conspiracy and all the mechanics of criminal law. And so they said, that's a difference here. We don't have to talk about the savings clause. Well, a couple of caveats on that. One is, it makes no sense to limit the savings clause to theft and not apply it to conspiracy to theft. And I go into some detail on that in the paper. But secondly, to the extent that Chapter 2 isn't within the area of the savings clause, then it's a heap of problems already for state laws because it's full of protections, big, important protections, much more than this. Which state laws do not provide. So it's not going to help that much. Third problem, the High Court actually, despite saying we didn't have to talk about savings clauses, gave a lot of hints that I don't much like savings clauses. And in Momcilovic, this came up too. The problem with savings clauses is Parliament's telling us what it intended, but that's for us to work out. All right? So the final line is actually from the Commonwealth Solicitor General in Momcilovic, and here was his gambit. Absent Section 300.4, which is the drug savings laws, it would be necessary to engage in an inferential interpretive exercise of the kind that was engaged in quite properly in Dixon. Well, I don't know where he found any inferential interpretive exercise in the 500-word, here are four differences, the High Court did, but we know why he said it. What he's saying to the High Court is, how about you do in future cases what you should have done in Dixon, all right? And so this could save the day, believe me, because the drug laws and many of the others are full of subtle hints that they were intended to work concurrently with state laws. There's basically no doubt at all that the Commonwealth government wanted the state laws to survive. And so to the extent the High Court is willing to read these subtle hints and sort of drift into indirect inconsistency in its arguments, this will reduce the problem. It will not resolve the problem, though, because savings clauses won't be a lay-down mazare for the federal government. In fact, think of the position of drafters of federal criminal laws in the future, right? Now, when you're expanding federal criminal law, until now, what you've done is put in a savings clause for state laws, so you don't have any problems. The High Court is hinting it's not going to read those savings clauses, but it might read subtle hints. So in future, drafters are going to have to scatter subtle hints into legislation, but they have to be pretty subtle. If they're not subtle enough, the High Court might refuse to listen. All right? And this is all, mind you, in the name of making the law easier to understand for citizens. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
I'm sure you agree, three very perceptive and entertaining presentations. Just in relation to Jeremy's comments, as a sentencing judge, there's some real and significant issues about the crossover between state and federal crime. It arose in New South Wales in relation to manufacture in the drug area. There's a decision of Chung and Choi, which you might like to look at, where we tried to give reason to the way or the sentencing patterns in relation to state and federal offences. The offence is perhaps the same, exactly the same offence. Anyway, any questions for anyone? Surely there must be. Right at the back.
Thank you. Hi, my name's Danielle Allen Piper. I'm a senior teaching fellow at Bond University. I just have a question for Jeremy. In this decision, the 109 decision, do you think that the scope of the decision will only apply where the Commonwealth law is more lenient, or do you think it could extend where it's actually more harsh? So, for example, where a Commonwealth criminal offence might have extraterritorial scope, like the child sex tourism offences, whereas a state offence wouldn't, does that then on that same principle give rise to an inconsistency?
Yeah, the logic is surely the same, which is that if the state... The danger of having inconsistent laws is that the Commonwealth might find its approach frustrated if the state gets in first and charges first. And that applies whether the Commonwealth law is more lenient or less lenient. For example, if the Commonwealth law is nasty and tough but the states get in first and charge, then that undermines the Commonwealth law because the state law might lead to an acquittal, which would then be difficult to deal with, to say the least, by the Commonwealth government. So, yeah, the arguments seem to work the same. That being said, the judgment is full of, you know, lines about liberty. And so to the extent that that matters, and it doesn't obviously appear to matter, but if they're built into this idea that somehow it's about Commonwealth protections, that could be a limit. But I can't see the logic being different. And just to be clear too, Dixon isn't limited to criminal offences or criminal law at all. I'm just sticking to that. But it seems to me you could make similar arguments about other areas of the law.
You're all waiting for lunch, are you? Well, it would seem you've managed to placate all reasonable inquiry. Can I again thank our three speakers? Each of them has delivered a paper of real significance. We are extraordinarily grateful. Thank you very much indeed.
Round them up for a photo.
Yeah, I'll do it.